Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 90-year-old Glenn Brehm of Gilroy, California. He was just 17 when he enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1942. You'll find photos of what he looked like then and, of course, now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you ever find yourself in Gilroy, the garlic capital of the world, you might want to check out the ruins of the Henry Miller Mansion on Mount Madonna. Henry Miller was a German immigrant who landed in San Francisco in 1850 with just $6 in his pocket, but became the most prolific cattle rancher in the country. Glenn Brehm's grandmother was first cousin to the cattle king of California, and that's how his family ended up in this country. Henry Miller paved the way, and relatives like Glenn's grandmother followed. So we have Henry Miller to thank for this courageous Marine who survived the Battle of Tarawa with the 2nd Marine Division in November of 1943, and by June of 44 was headed to another major Pacific battle, one detailed in James Campbell's book, The Color of War, which includes a few mentions of a young Marine named Glenn Pluto Brehm.
And the next one was Saipan.
Saipan.
And I've talked to quite a few guys who were there, and I've heard some gruesome stories from that. But I understand, if I'm reading this correctly, that a book that features a little bit of your story, sounds like one of your first stories on Saipan wasn't necessarily a deadly one or a scary one, but a really smelly one. Did you really make a foxhole in a septic tank your first night over there?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, I don't know. It was easy digging, but when it seeped in at night, well, there was nothing. You were stuck in there. You had to stay there, so.
And then you were probably stuck with that smell for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It would, not only that smell, you had all kinds of smells that you couldn't get rid of. You didn't even change your socks for a couple of weeks sometimes.
Yeah. Did you catch a little ribbing over that, the septic tank?
Yeah, a little bit. They stayed away from me for a while, but.
What was that like, and how was it different from what you'd experienced on Tarawa?
Well, there was more artillery fire from on Saipan. They had these rockets coming in. You could hear them coming, going, shoo, 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 shoo. And then they'd hit, and the minute they'd hit, why, you could move a little bit. And we always tried to go to where one already hit. You felt you were safer there. And the first night we were on there, they told us to pull back with the heavy shelling, so we headed back for the beach, and you had to wait when these barrages were over. In between, you'd to run a little bit and then dig down again and then run some more. But guys were getting picked off all around and just wondered if you were going to be next. But,
well, and I have to imagine there were a few moments where that came pretty close to happening.
Oh, yeah. There was quite a few times. One time I was laying on my stomach on Saipan, and the bullet hit right under my eye, and it put dirt in there, and I couldn't see out of that eye at all. And
so it hit the dirt right under your eye,
yeah,
and splashed dirt right
yeah.
up on you. Matter of inches.
Yeah. And then another time, one grazed my wrist, and I was laying there. Another time on my BAR, I had my head down like that, and the bullet hit the operating handle and blew that off. And that was a loud concussion.
Yeah.
But those are the ones that you don't know how many go by that you don't know were close. I mean, if you hear it, it's already gone.
What kinds of assignments did you guys have there? Can you give us a taste of the day-to-day, what your experience might have been like?
Well, for some reason, I took out quite a few patrols. They'd say, well, Pluto, take three guys and go 300 yards ahead here and see what you can find. So you never knew what you're going to run into. Then another time, our platoon was kind of cut off, and we didn't know where the rest of the outfit was. The captain says, Pluto, take some volunteers and go back and see if you can find the rest of the outfit. So I just took my whole squad. They all wanted to go with me, so we went back, and we didn't know where we were going. And we just started out, and just down below us, about 100 yards, there was a Japanese guy in there going through some food, rattling cans, and the guys wanted to shoot him. And I said, no, if we shoot, we're going to give away our position. Let's let him go for now. So we went and we had to go back. We went back about 400 or 500 yards and finally saw a guy sitting on a hill, and he waved at us, and that was our outfit. So we went up, and he says, as we got there, just ahead of us, there were three Japs right ahead of us that turned to the right, and we turned to the left where he was. And he says, they couldn't have been 50 yards ahead of us. So anyway, we got up there, and then they said, send somebody back to get our outfit. So I sent two guys back to bring them, so the whole platoon came back then. So they were happy to get out of there.
I suppose so. Yeah. How are your food supplies there on Saipan? Did you have lots of hot, comfy meals to enjoy on a nightly basis?
K-rations and C-rations. there wasn't much hot food at all.
Did you get used to that?
Yeah.
Didn't have much of a choice?
That was it. You got spaghetti and meatballs we got in cans and once in a while, and powdered eggs and the K-rations. But you got used to it.
Did the indefinite nature of it ever get to you? In other words, day after day after day of this kind of combat, being on edge, knowing the enemy's after you and not knowing when it's all going to end, did that ever weigh on you?
Well, I guess it did, but you didn't pay that much attention to it. You knew you were stuck there anyway, so it's no use worrying about it. Yeah, I can't remember how I felt, really.
But you were there till the end of that one, until the island was secure?
Yeah, well, then we went, they took some of us with some replacements to go over to Tinian, which was pretty close. So we went over, we landed on there then, and that wasn't too bad. We were there a few days, and then came back to Saipan again. And finally, we left there, and then we went to Guadalcanal for a rest camp, which was a good place to go, Guadalcanal. So we were there for 6 months, and then preparing for Okinawa.
I want to ask you a little more about Saipan in light of a couple of things that veterans have shared about that battle. One, I've talked to some guys who were involved in situations, and there was one very famous one at the end of that battle of bonsai charges by the enemy.
Yeah.
Did you experience firsthand or witness anything
like
that?
Oh, yeah. And there was one time they were charged uphill, and they were throwing grenades up at us, and they were rolling back on themselves. I mean, wasn't much there. They were just picking them off. I mean, but they'd scream and come running up there, throwing grenades.
How did you feel about the enemy? I know that sounds like a goofy question. But.
Well, to me at that time, I knew they were going to be shooting at me. It didn't bother me at all shooting at any of them. Some of the replacements that came in, they'd see a couple of guys in a foxhole and holler, "Barman, Barman," and call me over to shoot them. They wouldn't do it. And So I remember there was one time, I don't know, there's probably a dozen of them through this one little valley we went through there. And every one of them would just holler, "Barman, Barman, here's a couple here." But you get used to it, and it didn't bother me. There was one time it did. The only one that really bothered me, one of them put his hands up like he was praying. But I didn't have time to think. They says, "Don't take any prisoners coming through there." So
yeah,
I shot him too. So that bothered me.
I could see that.
Yeah,
but there are plenty of stories of guys who would fake surrender.
Oh yeah.
Or come into your camps at night, or pretend to be American,
right.
Or all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Were you able to sleep at night?
Yeah, pretty well. But I mean, you don't get a long sleep. You sleep a few minutes, and usually there were two of you in a hole where one could sleep a little bit and then the other one stay awake.
And you mentioned the in that bonsai charge, the Japanese throwing grenades uphill and they'd roll back down on them. From what I read in that book, there was an incident where you almost got blown up by one of your...
A buddy of mine, yeah.
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 Tell me what happened there.
Well, they sent us to, if I remember right, to get some grenades or something. And when we came back, the sniper picked at us. So we got behind a rock. It was a little shack. So I told this, Frank Border was the guy with me. I says, go around the back and see if you can throw a grenade in there. And if he comes out the front, I'll get him. So he went around the back and he threw a grenade, but he threw it over the top of the shack and it blew up. I ducked behind a rock. It blew up right in front of me. So then anyway, I went in and shot him. He wasn't too much trouble there. So that took care of that one.
Yeah, I could see how that one would get your attention too. And the other thing on Saipan that has been, you know, well publicized over the years, that's just one of the great tragedies of the war, is the misinformation, the propaganda that the Japanese were sharing with the inhabitants of the island, and saying things that caused women and children to jump off
that suicide cliff. We saw that many times, jumping off the suicide cliffs. They'd just throw their kids off and then jump after them.
That had to sicken you.
Oh, boy, that was bad.
Well, I guess when you see an enemy that is doing things like that and making those kind of choices, maybe it strengthens your will or your resolve a little bit to finish this?
Yeah. In fact, one of those, we had some of the civilians in a little camp, and this one girl wanted some food, I guess, so I gave her a thing of K rations. She gave me two rings. They were just made out of aluminum or stainless steel. Mm-hmm. One of them had a shape of a diamond on it. I guess they were her wedding rings. So I remember I brought those home. I don't know whatever happened to them. I had them for years.
Wow. Told you how much that food meant to her.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Well, and it also underscores how much freedom meant to everybody at that time. Yeah. And I know you were just a teenager, and you're out there, and you don't have a ton of time to think about this and that. But we're so far removed from it now, 70 years later. And I don't know if people today really have a firm grasp for what America was like then, or what it meant to fight for your country, or what you were fighting for. Can you help us maybe understand what was motivating you and the guys you were fighting with?
Well, I guess just having declared war on us, what they did on Pearl Harbor and everything. That's what, and then I had time to go to a couple of movies right after that. They came out fast. Wake Island and Back to Bataan and some of those movies, and that gets you going more. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't wait to get in.
And then you were seeing the real deal, which is a lot different from a movie.
Yeah.
So you get on from Saipan and Tinian. That's three battles now that you've survived. Mm-hmm. And I bet you were probably pretty surprised by that, given how many guys around you did not do that, or at least got sent home.
That's right.
Did you have a lot of personal friends who were wounded or killed?
Not really, because you're not with guys that long. I mean, after each campaign, where there's only a few of you left, then they bring in replacements. Mm-hmm. And then you start off again with a new bunch. But no, there was none of them that I was in there. Like in the Navy or the Air Corps, they're in there together for months and months.
Right.
But we weren't.
But the nickname stuck with you.
Yeah, that did.
Okay. Okinawa. Did you have a sense before that battle that the war was winding down, that you guys were close?
No, I don't think so. Well, we knew we were getting closer to Japan, but we thought we were going to have to go into Japan to finish it off. Mm-hmm. Remember, we landed there on Easter Sunday, April Fool's Day. It was, April the 1st. Yeah, I was on there a month and a half before I finally got hit. I think I got hit May the 14th.
Wow, that is a long time. So what were you doing for that month and a half?
Gone, moving up in battles. One day you'd run into trouble, then you'd go 3 or 4 days and nothing would happen. Then you'd move up a little further and run into some more opposition.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with, or maybe the most terrifying part of the whole experience for you?
Well, it was all terrifying. Remember, they wanted, just 3 days before I got shot, they wanted to send me home to go to officer's candidate school. They said they'd ship me out right now. And I says, no, after this was over, I'd be coming home anyway, because after four campaigns, they automatically sent you home. And then, so 3 days later, then I got shot.
And this is quite a story. And you know, I made reference to it earlier. You know, you come back and you marry Muriel and you would have 5 children. Now there's 15 grandkids and 32 great-grandkids. And this always amazes me. None of those people would be here if your rifle hadn't jammed. That's crazy.
That's what my kids keep telling me.
Yeah, well, because they're pretty thankful to be alive.
Yeah.
And we need to hear that whole story, but it's time for another break. Head to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and video of Glenn Brehm. Once a Marine, always a Marine, right? He is going strong at 90, but we're going to understand just how close he came to paying the ultimate price as a 19-year-old on Okinawa when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.